the global baby industry, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. A lot of couples spend a lot of money on fertility treatments, trying to have a baby. And if they don't succeed, many turn to international surrogacy programs in places like Ukraine.
Pay once and try as many times as you need until you get a take-home baby.
And the surrogate mothers get something that's in short supply in their country.
Money. Ukraine, no money.
Plus, an update on one little girl whose voice was heard by millions last week. She's a six-year-old from El Salvador who was separated from her mom at the U.S.-Mexico border.
I feel that if any family has a chance of being reunited quickly, it's this family.
That's all ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us. So much to talk about today. Justice Kennedy is retiring. We'll look at what that has to do with the global battle over abortion rights. We've got an update on the immigrant families separated at the U.S.-Mexico border, and a look ahead to this weekend's presidential election in Mexico. We're going to begin, though, with the global surrogacy industry. One in six couples in the U.S. is affected by infertility. That's according to a recent study by the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. So this week, we've been focusing on what for many is a last and expensive resort, hiring a surrogate. It's something many celebrities have done, but what if you're not a millionaire? Reporter Allison Herrera from our Across Women's Lives desk has the story of two women and two babies and the international ties that bind them.
We were never not trying. That's right.
Never not trying to have a baby. That's Bianca Smith. She and her husband Vinny live in South Pasadena, Florida. They've been together for 8 years, and they've always wanted a baby. They tried everything to increase their chances, even things outside the bedroom.
Acupuncture, you spent thousands on acupuncture. I was doing Reiki, anything, fertility massage, fertility yoga.
Nothing worked. So they turned to science. Eventually, Vinny agreed to in vitro fertilization treatments. That means taking an egg from one of Bianca's ovaries, injecting it with sperm, and then putting it into her uterus.
I first begged Vinny, I was like, can we find the money from somewhere, loans, like, you know.
Bianca was 38 years old when she started IVF treatments.
The first one was all excitement. We didn't expect it to work. Everyone says it's you take a roughly three chances and then it works. So and then our first one worked. So we were like, couldn't believe it. We were like, well, that's it. Our luck has changed. And then we miscarried that one. And that was one of the most devastating things for me. Sorry. I'm sorry.
Bianca and Vinny are not alone. Studies show that fertility for women in their mid to late 30s drops dramatically every year. And at Bianca's age, she wasn't optimistic. That's when Bianca looked at surrogacy as an option. But there was a catch.
If we don't have $100,000 to start, it's not going to happen. We can just forget it. It's starting at $100,000.
They had already spent more than $200,000 on IVF treatments. They had exhausted their savings, spent the inheritance from Vinny's grandparents, and asked for loans from their family members. They needed results, and agencies in the U.S. didn't offer that. Where could they get it? A friend had a suggestion.
Why don't you try Ukraine?
Ukraine. The Eastern European country has become the place where international commercial surrogacy is taking off. But it's not for everyone. The conservative, predominantly Christian country only allows married heterosexual couples, like Vinny and Bianca, to hire a surrogate. And the demand is growing in Ukraine. That's because the price of surrogacy has been dropping. I'll explain why in a minute. And you could have a baby. Guaranteed.
Pay once and try as many times as you need and until you get a take-home baby.
So, in October of 2016, Bianca and Vinny went for it. They sold their home in the UK. They paid $58,000 for what's called the VIP package to one of the largest fertility clinics in Ukraine.
We have just landed in the butter, you know. So charming, so friendly, so professional.
They met with representatives from Biotex.com, Center for Human Reproduction. They chose an egg donor and a gestational surrogate. Vinny contributed his sperm. And 9 months later...
At the moment, because they're so young...
Bianca said they got incredibly lucky. These are Bianca and Vinny's twin boys. Their Ukrainian surrogate agreed to be implanted with two embryos.
She was incredible, absolutely incredible. While she's lying there, we can hear other women giving birth down the passage, screaming. She was like, pop. Like, wow, you are a superwoman. Absolutely freaking amazing.
So, this is actually the clinic building, and we will go.
Tucked away in a tree-lined neighborhood about 5 miles away from the center of Kiev is a medical clinic. I'm putting the soles of my shoes into a device that suctions plastic wrap onto them to keep the germs off the clinic floors. This is the headquarters of Biotexcom. This is where Bianca's babies were created.
Here, normally, our surrogate mothers are waiting to enter into the check.
My tour guide is Anastasia Alexandrova, Director of International Business Development here. She shows me around the brightly lit rooms and modern clinic facilities. We see intended parents from all over the world filling out forms and signing contracts. In another building, we meet the women who are going to have those babies.
Девочки, вы не переживайте, мы никого не снимаем, мы просто рассказываем.
They sit crowded together on couches. I ask one woman why she's here.
Money. Ukraine, no money.
The money. The average wage in Ukraine is about $200 a month. That's why some argue that surrogacy is exploitation, a way for men and women with money to rent the wombs of women living in poorer countries. It used to be countries like India, Thailand, and Mexico had large surrogacy industries, but all those countries have made it illegal in recent years. That's created an opportunity for Ukraine to fill the gap in the market. And reproductive tourism is big business.
All-inclusive VIP surrogacy package is intended for the most fastidious customers. The luxurious service covers meeting at the airport and transfer by a VIP class car.
The luxury apartments and gourmet meals aside, what about the women getting paid to be surrogates?
No one is forcing no one.
For Biotexcom's Anastasia Alexandrova, this is a business transaction.
This is what I am asked about, exploitation, et cetera, et cetera. They make their choice not to have something very basic for living, no, but to have something extra.
The company is an international multi-million dollar business. They have offices in North America, Africa, Asia, and Europe. Bianca received what she was promised. She was guaranteed babies, and she got those babies. But she wasn't thrilled with Biotexcom. Those fancy hotels, they weren't as nice as the video portrayed. She feels they oversold in terms of quality of medical care and accommodation. Anastasia just rolls her eyes at this.
Seriously, guys, you got pregnant from the first attempt. Your kids are perfectly fine, in perfect health.
Biotexcom has been around for nearly 10 years, guaranteeing babies. That's led to criticism about how far they will go to make fertility possible for everyone. The company's website proudly shows off a pregnant woman in her 60s.
Yes, you read about 66 years old. Yeah, those are our clients.
That 66-year-old woman had an embryo implanted and had a child. That's an extreme case. But Biotexcom's bread and butter is providing couples like Bianca and Vinny healthy babies, worry-free. But Anastasia says the company takes care of their surrogates, too.
In this process, we always face two sides. One side is the side of intended parents. And from another side, we have responsibility in front of a surrogate mother and in front of her family.
In total, the woman who had Bianca's children walked away with $13,000. That's after having twins.
It's 600 meters. Take the exit on the right.
3 hours outside of Kiev is where Katerina lives.
Hi. Hi. Andrei.
She's 28 years old and is a slight woman, weighing maybe 100 pounds. She's got blonde streaks in her hair and immaculately done nails. Katerina is not her real name. She asked me to protect her identity because the issue of surrogacy is still a sensitive topic in the country. She is the woman who had Bianca's babies. She invites me into her new home. Her husband bought it with the money she earned as a surrogate.
Maybe let's go, I will show you my house.
First and foremost, we need to change the roof because it leaks.
She says it still needs some fixing up. It has three rooms, a kitchen with a stove, and wood oven. It's surrounded by a large garden where she grows all her vegetables, including the delicious potatoes she serves me for lunch. Katerina has two daughters of her own. One is 10 and the other is 9. Her older daughter loves school and singing. The house still has no running water, but Katerina says it looks a lot better from when they first bought it. Her husband installed new windows and took out a lot of debris, including thousands of pickling jars left behind by the previous owner. Before the house, they were renting an apartment, taking care of one of her sisters, and trying to pay off some medical bills. Then a friend told Katerina about becoming a surrogate.
Він був проти, ну, щоб піти на маму. Ну, по-перше, що в нас невелике місто, щоб ніхто...
She tells me that initially her husband was against it. He didn't want her to be a surrogate. He told her that they come from a small village and he didn't want people to see her or know about the surrogacy. But she told him she wanted to do it and that they needed the money. Katerina took the long bus ride to Biotexcom. There, she had two embryos implanted in her uterus. The doctors there assured her that she was healthy enough to carry twins.
Ну, з моїм весом, з моїм ростом, мені, ну, одне.
Katerina says she didn't have a choice, that with her height and weight, she should just get one embryo implanted. But the doctor kept telling her that she could carry two babies to term. Radmila Hiratsova is the director of medical law at Taras Shevchenko University in Kiev. She says women need to be educated about what is and what isn't allowed during the surrogacy process.
If those ladies had a chance to support their children, if they had a chance to accomplish their goals, life goals, they would probably not agree to become a surrogate.
Remember that thing about how surrogacy has gotten cheaper here? Well, that's because Ukraine has been a country in crisis for the last 4 years. In 2014, there was an uprising. The Russian-backed president, Viktor Yanukovych, was overthrown. Then came Crimea, and Russia took control of parts of eastern Ukraine. That conflict never really ended, and a casualty of this war? The economy. So now, there are more women needing money in Ukraine. More available surrogates brought the price down.
Я відповідаю, що це вибір без вибору. Якщо в нас легалізоване сурогатне материнство...
It's actually a choice without a choice. These women, they're not informed about the risks. And women in rural areas know less.
Women are exploited for their bodies as prostitutes and as surrogates. That's how feminist activist and doctor Olga Gajovich sees it.
Дати їй тільки вибір – це торгувати власним тілом.
Women are fighting hard against poverty, and they are faced with a choice of surrogacy or prostitution.
Katerina doesn't spend her time thinking about the ethics of surrogacy. She still works the overnight shift in a bakery because she wants to have a house with indoor plumbing and a larger room for her children.
Pomodoro.
Before I leave to drive back to Kiev, Katerina tells me that Biotexcom called her a few days ago. They asked her how she was feeling and if she would be interested in being a surrogate again. Katerina is experienced, young, and healthy. And clinics like Biotexcom want her. Because there are so many more Biancas and Vinnies out there who want women like Katerina to have their children. For a price. For The World, I'm Alison Herrera.
Coming up tomorrow, we look at a country once known as the womb of Asia. For over a decade, India was the place to go for international surrogacy. But the booming baby industry catering to foreigners was shut down in 2016. Now surrogacy is only available to citizens of India. And even that may be coming to an end. That's coming up tomorrow. We follow up on one immigrant child still separated from his family. That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. The Trump administration may have ended its policy of separating the families of undocumented migrants, but it's become clear in the last week that bringing those families back together will not be easy. Exhibit A might be the case of Alison Jimena Valencia Madrid. You probably don't know her by name, but you may have heard her voice. That's because she's one of the children whose cries and pleas were captured in an audio clip released last week by the news site ProPublica. Ginger Thompson is a senior reporter at ProPublica, and she's been following the young girl's journey to reunite with her family.
Jimena is a six-year-old Salvadoran girl who came to this country with her mother on a month-long journey across Central America and Mexico. She was quickly separated from her mother after they crossed the border into the United States. And what you can hear on this tape are the cries of numerous children who are with her in this Border Patrol detention facility. And Jimena is asking over and over again for authorities who are with her to let her make a phone call or to make a phone call on her behalf. And she pleads with them. One call, she says, to her aunt's house, because her aunt, she believes, will pick her up and let her stay there instead of in this facility until her mother can join them.
And was she able to call her aunt?
She was able to call her aunt. In fact, she rattled off a phone number that you can hear on the tape. And I was able to call that number and confirm, in fact, that it was the phone number of Jimena's aunt.
And has Jimena been able to talk to her mother, who's at a detention facility in a different state?
It took several days. Jimena was taken to a shelter in Arizona. Her mother was taken to an ICE detention facility in Texas. And it was several days before the mother and daughter could talk. For a long time, they spoke through the aunt.
Ginger, I want you to walk us through the process that's taken place so far to try to get Jimena and her mother reunited.
The few times that I've been able to speak to Jimena's mother by telephone suggested to me that not much had been done at all. She's gotten no word from authorities about how she's going to be reunited, what she needs to do to be reunited with her daughter, when that reuniting might happen. So there's been no real change in her status so far, and no real change in what's going on with Jimena either. So far, there just doesn't seem to be much there.
What do officials say who you've spoken to when you point out, look, in this case, we've got real information. This girl has the phone number. We know the mother. We know where the mother is. I mean, what do they say in response?
Well, they're mostly saying that they've got an overwhelming number of people to deal with. And the backlog is so intense that they say that they don't have, you know, enough people, enough lawyers, enough authorities to actually move these cases quickly. And it's unclear to me that they know where all the children are that belong to the parents. For example, in this case, Jimena had a phone number that allowed her to give authorities some sense of where her family is, and her family could tell authorities where the child's mother is. Not all children have phone numbers. Some children aren't old enough to count, or they're not old enough to know their parents' whole names.
Do we have a confirmed number of families who've been reunited since President Trump ended the policy of separating them?
Well, we have the number that authorities have given us in the first few days. After the president began to retreat from the separation policy, they announced that they had quickly put 500 children back together with their parents, reunified them. But in the days since then, it's unclear whether there's been any movement at all.
Do we know whether those reunifications that they've said have occurred, are they between a kid and a parent who were separated and in two different facilities? Or in some cases, are they reuniting a child who was separated with, say, a parent who might have been deported back to their home country or might be living in an undocumented way in the U.S.?
It is unclear who those children are. They could be all of the above. They could be all children who really hadn't been separated from their parents. We just don't know at this point. We do know that parents have been deported without their children, and their children are still here in the United States. And those parents are stuck far, far away without any clarity on how their children will be returned to them. And so, you know, the more we sort of look at how this policy is playing out, the more nervous making it becomes in terms of, you know, how to put these families back together again.
Based on your reporting of this child separation policy, the end of it, how it's all going on, and your knowledge of Ximena and her mother and the facts of their case and the information that they have, are you hopeful that that particular family is going to be reunited?
Well, look, I feel that if any family has a chance of being reunited quickly, it's this family. And I think that's largely due to Ximena and her sort of composure under enormous pressure. This six-year-old little girl who memorized a phone number only a couple of hours before crossing the border into the United States and managed to keep that number in her head after being, you know, taken away without warning from her mother, is quite stunning.
In listening to that audio, it's interesting because the voice that affected me the most was the kid who kept saying, "Papi, Papi." Do you know what's happened to that child or the other in that particular group?
No, I don't. You know, unlike Ximena, those children just gave me no other indication of who they were or who their parents were. And I haven't been able to get any of that from Ximena's family. So Ximena was sort of our only real opportunity to identify any of the children on that tape.
Are you going to stick with the story and follow Ximena?
We are planning to do that. We're doing our best.
Ginger Thompson is a senior reporter at ProPublica. Thanks a lot, Ginger.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Hills. The Trump travel ban upheld by the Supreme Court includes a way for travelers to apply for an exception. But this former consular official says those requests are almost always denied.
If you, as a consular officer, don't believe that you're going to be able to get this waiver, you're just going to refuse it.
That story is coming right up here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy has been a decisive vote in hugely important cases in the U.S. for 30 years. One of the last, just this week, was the court's decision upholding President Trump's latest ban on travel to the U.S. from seven countries. The ban affects residents of five Muslim-majority nations, Syria, Libya, Iran, Yemen, and Somalia. It also includes certain individuals from North Korea and Venezuela. The administration bolstered its winning arguments for the ban by pointing to a waiver process that supposedly allows people to apply for exceptions. But some have called that process a fraud. Among them is Chris Richardson. He's a former U.S. diplomat who filed an affidavit in the Supreme Court case, an affidavit which was later quoted by Justice Stephen Breyer in his dissenting opinion. Richardson served in several countries before leaving the State Department earlier this year. Chris, say someone applying for a visa walked into a U.S. embassy a few years ago. Can you explain how granting a visa used to work?
Once you apply online, you get an appointment, you go to the embassy, and you're interviewed by a consular officer. Depending on the type of visa you interview for, the officer is going to measure certain things under a section of the immigration law. And so what we're looking for is to make sure you're not someone who's going to break the law or stay in the country. And we do have a level of security checks, military intelligence databases, biometric screening, and complex risk-based algorithms to determine whether someone might pose a harm to the United States. And so you would run through all of those things, and then based on whether that person qualifies for the visa, you would give it or deny it.
But the key thing is here, it's the consular officer, him or herself, would make that determination?
For the most part, yes. Now, if someone's name might be a close match to someone else's name, or if the person had certain types of jobs, or if they were involved in certain types of things, then, you know, in those scenarios, we would talk to the visa office in Washington, D.C. for guidance about those issues, if that person might pose a security risk. But it was very narrowly tailored to that specific applicant.
A few weeks ago, you submitted a sworn affidavit to a district court in New York. What did the affidavit say?
The gist of the affidavit is that when you create a system where you have tons of barriers, barriers that didn't exist before, you're discouraging consular officers from making that final decision. One thing that people have to understand about the context of being a consular officer is that you're expected to do 80, 90, 100 visa interviews per day. Speed and efficiency are very, very important. And if you, as an officer, are being told, okay, so if you want to grant a waiver, you can grant a waiver, but you have to talk to your consular manager, and then your consular manager has to talk to the visa office in Washington, D.C., and they might or might not grant it. For a lot of consular officers, the easier answer is just going to be to refuse the visa and not talk to the person and not bring the person in.
So these new barriers that you're discussing, are these things that have been imposed by the Trump administration?
Yes. The first ban came out within days of him being sworn in as president. And, you know, that was poorly written. It basically banned all categories of visas for these individuals from these eight countries. It really wasn't carefully crafted. But as time went on, he learned, or his administration rather, learned methods to make their discriminatory impact carefully hidden. And they used the State Department and Consular Affairs and Department of Homeland Security to push this discriminatory animus. This waiver process alleges that, you know, if the person meets undue hardship, doesn't pose a security or public safety risk, and is in our national interest, that person could then get a visa. But that's all on paper. For practicality purposes and reality purposes, you've just created a new barrier that really discourages officers from bothering to even try to get that person a visa.
If you look at the numbers of visa waivers that have been granted for the past year or so, does it suggest that few are being granted?
Yes. Recently, the State Department admitted to Senator Van Hollen that only about 2% of visa hardship waivers have even been granted. Going back to the context, you have an officer who has maybe 90 to 100 interviews per day. That officer has in his toolbox something called 214B. Which in consular parlance means that you as the applicant have to overcome a presumption that you are going to live illegally in the United States. And so you as the applicant have to actually convince that officer within 5 minutes of an interview or even less that you have an undue hardship, that you're not a public safety risk, and that somehow the visa office and your consular manager are both going to agree that issuing you a visa is in the national interest. I don't think that there has to be an instruction from the president or anybody. Knowing the way consular officers work and knowing that our natural inclination is to do things in an efficient and fast way. If you, as a consular officer, don't believe that you're going to be able to get this waiver, you're just going to refuse it. And those officers who've gone through trying to apply for the waiver, they've seen that it might not be issued at all.
You ended up leaving the Foreign Service in March, is that right?
Yes.
Can you explain how you came to that decision?
I had personal issues with my father passing away and wanting to be closer to home. But ultimately, I just felt that we as a State Department gave up fighting, that we were outraged during the initial ban, and hundreds of us signed a dissent memo saying that we weren't going to stand for this. And then we stood for it. We stood by. And gradually, as time went on, what was opposition became, for many officers, support, saying, well, some people get waivers, and therefore we should respect this system. And I understand that. I was in the State Department for 7 years. I think that as a consular officer, you do the best job you can do. But I know for me, I really felt that the message we were sending to Muslims throughout the world and also to people in these quote-unquote whole countries wasn't the message I wanted to be a part of.
Do you think that if documents or data about the travel ban waiver process, the kind of things we've just been talking about, do you think they'd have an impact on the legality of the travel ban?
It's hard to know because the State Department is sort of keeping those cards close to its vest, right? They don't want people to see these percentages because they don't want people to dig too deeply into it. I think if there's any criticism of the plaintiffs in the Trump v. Hawaii case is that I think all of us were pushing for a quick and steady win rather than going through a rigorous discovery process. And I don't think that future plaintiffs are going to make that same mistake and that they're going to make State Department cough up much more information than they've been willing to cough up thus far. And so, yeah, I think that if we were to release all the information, you would see that maybe this waiver process and exemption process aren't as rigorous as Chief Justice Roberts had suggested in his ruling.
Chris Richardson is a former Foreign Service officer with the State Department. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you so much.
Whatever your position on a woman's right to choose abortion, you're probably thinking a lot today about who might replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. Kennedy has often been the crucial vote turning back challenges to the court's 1973 Roe versus Wade decision that legalized abortion. Now, though, President Trump seems set to nominate a replacement for Kennedy who could well vote to overturn that decision. And that could mean abortion could be recriminalized in elite parts of the U.S. So what might that look like? Law professor Michelle Oberman has some ideas. She spent the last decade looking at the impact of abortion laws in Latin America. The practice is illegal or strongly restricted in much of the region, but Oberman says many women nonetheless turn to drugs that induce abortion, and these drugs are increasingly available. And just to note, this interview includes some graphic descriptions.
Drugs that induce abortion are available on the ground almost everywhere in the world, legally or illegally. They can be taken relatively safely up until 9 weeks of pregnancy legally, and it seems to be that they actually induce abortions beyond that, albeit with some need for backup medical care when there's a hemorrhage. But we already know that abortion looks like this in countries where it's illegal because it's the dominant mode of terminating pregnancies in countries like Brazil, where it's illegal in virtually all cases, and yet around half of the million or so estimated illegal abortions a year happen through medical abortion.
Where else around the globe is abortion still illegal?
It's completely illegal in El Salvador and in some neighboring countries in Central America, Honduras, Nicaragua, Dominican Republic. Chile had a ban in place until last year, and they actually repealed it and replaced it with a law that allows for abortion in the case of threat to a mother's life or rape.
And of course, Ireland.
Yeah, Ireland just reversed its ban earlier this year. The trend has been among many countries to slightly liberalize the abortion laws. And I think this is partly in response to the reality that abortion rates don't go down when abortion is illegal. The best way to combat abortion, if you don't like it, is to place supports and meaningful alternatives for poor women who are inclined to terminate pregnancies they might otherwise carry because they don't have the money to raise children.
You've spent a lot of time in Latin American countries and found, although abortion, as you say, is almost always illegal, it's still very commonplace. How does that play out on the ground?
So on the ground, what happens is that women who are feeling a need to terminate an unplanned pregnancy use smartphones to buy abortion drugs. There still are some back alley abortion providers. But the much more dominant method of terminating an unwanted pregnancy involves using a smartphone to find somebody who's able to sell you misoprostol or Cytotec, which is part of the drug that we use in this country. And these drugs will fairly quickly end an unwanted pregnancy.
What happens when these drugs don't work as expected and women end up in emergency rooms?
When the drugs don't work, women end up going to the emergency room bleeding. It's not unusual for women to come to emergency rooms bleeding, though, because as many as 25% of our pregnancies end in miscarriage. So unless she tells the doctor that she's hemorrhaging because she took abortion drugs, there's no way for the doctor to know whether she intentionally brought on her miscarriage or not. What happens in countries where there's a complete ban in place is that doctors feel torn between the obligation to maintain patient confidentiality, which is a norm ethically around the world, one of the most really closely held and revered tenets of the doctor-patient relationship, and the pressure to report women they suspect of having deliberately ended their pregnancies. In most countries around the world with restrictive abortion laws, women are not themselves prosecuted. But in countries like El Salvador, where they do prosecute women for abortion, doctors feel that tension and they report patients to the police. But let me be very clear about this. The patients who are reported to police are overwhelmingly poor patients who seek care at public hospitals. They don't have the money to buy a private relationship with a doctor that they can trust will be confidential.
Tell us about a young Salvadoran woman you met named Christina and what happened to her in an emergency room in El Salvador.
Yeah, Christina is a really typical example of what happens in a country that's determined to enforce an abortion ban. So Christina was expecting her second child. She was actually quite excited about it. She was living at her mom's house so that she could be near to the hospital when her time to deliver came. At around 7 or 8 months of pregnancy, she started to experience pretty intense cramps. In the middle of the night, she felt a really intense pain, dragged herself down the hallway to her bathroom, was hemorrhaging, and passed out. Her mom heard the noise and took literally the tin can that had all the money that they had, all change in their house, and went out and gave it to a neighbor and asked him to drive Christina to the hospital. And when she woke up, there were faces around the bed screaming at her, "Y el bebé? Where's the baby? Where's the baby?" She came to thinking at first that they were nurses and doctors, and then was spent literally 3 hours in interrogation immediately after the surgery. They went back to the home and found a full-term baby in the toilet and then proceeded to take her from the hospital directly to the prison where she was charged with having deliberately killed her child. Now, we might think that a case like that couldn't happen here. And the truth is that for women with money and a private attorney, the chances are pretty good that at that moment in time, the prosecution would have sort of been derailed. You would have said, wait a minute, this isn't a person who deliberately killed her child. There isn't evidence even that the child was born alive. But poor women don't always have access to top-flight legal assistance. And so in El Salvador, it actually took 4 years for her to get a lawyer who was able to say, wait, there's just absolutely no evidence that this was a deliberate act on her part, and certainly not even basic medical evidence that the baby was born alive.
It's a harrowing story, but how relevant is it for women in the U.S.?
It's relevant for women in the U.S. in that we need to think about how we preserve doctor-patient confidentiality. In the scheme of things today, as we contemplate life without Roe versus Wade, I think there's more important things for us to be thinking about. I think we need to be thinking in a very concrete way about the places in the country where abortion is likely to remain legal, regardless of changes in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on abortion. We need to be thinking about what it's going to look like for the poorest among us, who can't afford the plane ticket to California or to Massachusetts or to New York, where abortion is likely to remain legal. And for those who are actually deeply concerned about ending abortion in this country, we need to think about how to go about pushing back on the problem of poverty, because women end pregnancies in this country disproportionately when they can't afford to parent. Half of all abortions in this country, half of them go to 13% of the women who live below the poverty line. 75% of our abortions go to women within 200% of the poverty line. These aren't women who are saying, gee, I want to have an abortion so I can fit into my bikini. Right. These are women who are saying, I can't afford this child. If we want to end abortion in this country, we need to look at the countries that love their babies and have the lowest abortion rates in the world. We need to look to Western Europe. We need to look to countries like Israel and figure out what they're doing to push back on abortion. And that's an agenda that all of us should share.
Michelle Obermann is the author of Her Body, Our Laws, on the front line of the abortion war from El Salvador to Oklahoma. She's a professor of law at Santa Clara University. Thanks, Michelle.
My pleasure.
We've got a big midterm election looming in just a few months. The outcome will say a lot about the direction the country takes in the next few years. But there's another election coming up just this weekend that could also have a big impact here in the U.S. It's the presidential election in Mexico on Sunday. Polls suggest a defeat for the current ruling party, known as the PRI, and a victory for Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's the founder of the left-leaning Morena Party. At his closing campaign speech last night, a huge crowd was already calling López Obrador presidente. Jorge Valencia is a reporter for station KJZZ in Phoenix. He's based in Mexico City. Jorge, tell us about Andrés Manuel López Obrador. Who is he?
Andrés Manuel López Obrador is a 64-year-old man who is a former mayor of Mexico City. This is his third time running for the candidacy. And for the most part, he has been somebody who has given a message of wanting to support policies that support the working class. And so some of the things that he did as mayor of Mexico City reflected that. He created subsidies for metro fares. And in the three times that he has been campaigning, his message has been pretty consistent. And that seems to be that those people that we just heard of shouting, president, 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 it seems to be a lot of what people have connected with.
You were actually there yesterday when people were shouting, president, 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 and you heard López Obrador make his closing campaign speech. What was the mood like?
You know, it's unlike anything that I've seen in covering presidential races in the United States. He concluded his campaign at this very iconic stadium in Mexico City that fits about 90,000 people. It had the atmosphere of like a rock concert. In fact, there were artists performing. There was a cumbia group. And there was a woman that I happened to be standing with at the very, very top of the stadium when López Obrador came out. And she started crying when she came out. It was such an emotional moment for her. Her name is Pilar Betanzos. I'd like to introduce you to her. And here's a little bit of what she told us.
And she's holding a sign that she made at home that says, my vote is not for sale.
As you can just hear from her voice, this seems to be something that's very personal for her. She and several other people who I spoke with said that they have been voting for him for years. This is the third time that they're going to vote for him. And they really do believe that their candidate is going to get elected.
What's the appeal of López Obrador? I mean, if you were talking to supporters, how would they describe him? What would they say about why they're voting for him?
He, as a candidate, has really been able to strike a chord to make it really personal for people. There was somebody else who I spoke with who has parents who are both in their 70s, and she said that López Obrador, when he was a mayor, that he instituted some policies that have helped the elderly. So he really has struck a chord with the working class, with a broad swaths of the population, perhaps something even tones that we have heard even in campaigns in the United States.
President Trump has had a lot to say about Mexico since he became president and even before. What has López Obrador said about the relationship with the U.S.?
I think the biggest thing that he has said to his supporters is that he really wants to create economic opportunities. He wants to create more jobs for people here in Mexico so that people have less of a need to leave rural parts of Mexico and go to the United States to pursue work. Now, regarding President Trump, his tone has been quite acrimonious towards Mexico and toward Mexicans. So all of the candidates who are running right now have responded quite strongly to that. But the most forceful candidate has been López Obrador. So it seems that if López Obrador were to win, the relationship between Mexico and the U.S. probably will not improve.
What's he saying about how he would deal with narco traffickers and the continued violence and scourge that's brought to Mexico?
The most salient thing that he has said about drug traffickers is that he would be willing to have dialogues with them and to create some sort of amnesty with some people that are involved in the drug trade. This, as you might imagine, has been quite incendiary, and his political opponents have attacked him over this over and over again for obvious reasons. At the same time, he hasn't gone into more detail about it. He hasn't gone into more detail of whether it's amnesty, what kind of amnesty it is. Is it for growers? Is it for the traffickers? Who is it for? I think the main takeaway here is that this is actually one of the main issues for voters here, public safety, which is very closely related to drug trafficking. And he has sort of positioned himself as the candidate who will try something different.
We will be following Election Day closely, but before we let you go, yesterday the Mexican national team got some help from South Korea in the World Cup. How are soccer fans reacting in Mexico City?
I think there's a lot of love for South Korea. So I think that Mexico-Korean relations, at least for now, will be, I hope, at a long-time high of peace and understanding.
Jorge Valencia is KJZZ's senior field correspondent in Mexico City. Thank you, Jorge.
Thanks, Carol.
Fun fact, Mexico's next World Cup game, a do-or-die showdown against powerhouse Brazil, is scheduled for Monday, which, of course, is the day right after Mexico's presidential election. Those will be two very intense days for our neighbors south of the border. And how about a little Bugat to close the show today? Bugat is a Mexican-Canadian artist from Quebec originally, and here he is with his song, Aquí.
Aquí, todo tiene onda, y me gusta así, querida tierra de leyenda. Ahí, todo tiene onda, y me gusta aquí, América Latina.
The lyrics are all about Latin America's complicated history and the tangle of poverty, corruption, and colonialism that have shaped the region for centuries. Bugat calls out those who ignore that history and celebrate some of the region's cultural icons.
Frida Kahlo, Diego Maradona, Jodorowsky, Línea Eslamona, Quino, Gabriel García Márquez, Pelé, Jorge Luis Borges, Iñárritu, Iguazú, Mercedes Sosa, Copacabana, Chespirito, El Popo, Víctor Jara, La Cordillera, Luis Alberto del Paraná, El Paraná.
Mexican-Canadian artist Bugat has the last word today with Aquí. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in.
Jodorowsky, Línea Eslamona, Quino, Gabriel García Márquez, Pelé, Jorge Luis Borges, Iñárritu, Iguazú.
PRI, Public Radio International.